Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer. Inside the evidence, behind the headlines, from someone who's been there. Here now, Jennifer Coffendaffer.
True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host, I'm Jen Coffendaffer. Thrilled to be joined today by Stephanie Walcott. She is a tool marks and just an expert that we're thrilled to have. She teaches at the university level, and she still does this every day, day in and day out. And that is deal with ballistics concerning weaponry of all sorts and nature. I have so many questions for her. This is a very specific science, and we are just so thrilled to have her. We've had her before. She's a friend of the show. She talked to us before about Delphi and those casings and the markings, whether that really matched Richard Allen's gun, just in terms of the information we had. And she gave some opinions on that. So this is the issue. For some reason, and we're not sure, other than the fact that she is coming to us live from the university setting, if that Wi-Fi situation is somehow interfering with her being able to get on with this. We've tried her with the phone and with her phone and with her laptop. So let me see if you all can hear her. Stephanie, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. Hopefully you can hear me.
You might really talk loudly, and I'll see what chat says here. Go ahead.
You want me to just do it through the phone and the computer? Hopefully one of the two will work.
Yes. Hey, chat, you're going to have to let me know. Can you hear her? Go ahead, Stephanie. Just say hi. Test one, two.
Hi, again, my name is Stephanie Walcott. I'm a professor here at the Virginia Commonwealth University Department of Forensic Science, but my main experience was almost 20 years as a firearm and tool mark examiner in a crime lab.
Perfect. Everybody said they can hear you, so we'll get to talk to you, and I'm going to put other pictures other than me up anyway, so here we go. We're here to talk about the case of Charlie Kirk, and we're examining this case not as a political reference, but rather in terms of investigatively, in terms of evidence. That is what we're here to decipher. And online, boy, have I seen a lot of people concerned about that bullet, about the bullet that came from the Mauser 30-06 rifle that was used to kill Charlie Kirk. First of all, Stephanie, can you talk to us about the ballistic capability in terms of how reliable, how responsible this weapon is in terms of being able to shoot and what would be a typical distance?
Well, the Mauser, well, the original Mauser design was back from wartime, right? So it was used for military purposes. Which again automatically kind of insinuates that it's a very reliable design and highly accurate for long distances. The more modern uses of the 30-06, including the Mauser, is for hunting purposes. So again, usually even in a hunting situation of large game is what it's designed for, generally they're working within a range of about 200 yards. So, you know, most hunters rely on them being relatively accurate or easy to correct over a 200-yard range, which was well within the range of this particular incident. Between that and the use of, say, you know, a high-quality scope on the rifle, it would be relatively easy to shoot accurately, especially if you're familiar with the firearm itself.
Right. And in this case, we know this firearm wasn't something he purchased online or something he put together like Luigi Mangione did. We know this was his grandfather's firearm.
Right. Right. And it looks, even from the pictures, you know, insinuating that, you know, from his grandfather, this was, you know, maybe one from the World War II times. It does look like, at least from some of the photographs, that, you know, it had a more modern stock on it. So it looks like it had been modernized at least somewhat. But again, this is a very kind of high quality, dependable firearm.
And I know you've had a chance to review the photo, and everybody in chat, I wanted to let you know, I have this photo, and again, I'm having a technical issue actually getting it downloaded for some reason. I have all these other pictures, and I have a picture of the ammunition, but the good news is Stephanie has had time to look and evaluate this gun. Is there anything else remarkable that you noticed in terms of the sight system, in terms of any other part, other than you said it's been modernized?
Yeah, and the reason I say that is that it looks like it has, you know, probably a black polymer-based stock assembly on it, which, you know, the more authentic Mausers, the older Mausers, usually have a wood stock, and they're a little bit more, a little bit longer and kind of bulkier, maybe a little bit heavier. So obviously this, you know, if it was originally with the wood stock and the more authentic style, it's been modernized to a lighter weight, easier to handle stock assembly. It also clearly has what looks like, you know, a large scope on top of it, probably, at least from what I've read, kind of a high quality scope on it. So again, this would be relatively user-friendly rifle to use for long distances shooting accurately, especially in a hunting type situation.
Now, according to at least the evidence that came out yesterday from the prosecutor, there was a claim made by Tyler Robinson, and again, for those who don't know, Tyler Robinson has been charged with murder and six other charges related to the assassination of Charlie Kirk in Orem, Utah. My question to you is, in terms of the scope, he actually says, you know, it's a $2,000 scope. In other words, he seems so concerned about losing this weapon, that it was a gift, that his father would be very upset with him if he didn't return it. It's so funny, right, that he's so concerned about returning the rifle and doesn't seem to be that concerned with the fact he's just murdered somebody and what that could mean for he and his family. But my question to you is in your experience, what kind of scope are we looking at? Is that a Leopold? Would that be even a higher level? What have you seen in that price range, if you know?
From looking at it from the outside, again, I will openly admit I am not a hunter, so I'm not as versed in, you know, identifying scopes from photographs as I am firearms. But just judging from even the price range that he puts it in, assuming that it's accurate and true, $2,000 is a pretty penny for a scope, so it's got to be a high quality scope to put that kind of money into it. So again, high dollar scope like that, it corrects for so much for the shooter that again, it makes even a moderate, you know, skilled shooter be able to shoot relatively accurately.
Right. I mean, I know a lot of people believed, especially early on, this must be some Mossad event where
I thought the same thing when
did?
I was like, wow, this is, I kind of put forth two scenarios of this is either a really trained, skilled, you know, like almost sniper level shooter, or this is somebody that is familiar with guns and has a really, really nice rifle with a good scope. So thought it was going to be the first, but I guess it turned out maybe to be the second.
Right, right. And you know, I've said routinely that at 150 yards or so, this would be a very easy shot. I just had a firearms class, and actually there was a guy not in my class, but in Utah, that had just he shot his rifle a mile and shot a milk jug.
Oh, wow.
It's the Mile Club. And so,
that's crazy.
Yeah. So just for everybody to know, this was no hill for a climber in terms of shooting from this distance. I want to talk about the actual round that was used. And in a 30-06, as you might imagine, it is a 30 caliber type weapon. And I've got some photos here of different cartridges, because I want everybody to see, and a cartridge means a projectile in conjunction with a casing. I just want everybody to see the sleekness of these rounds, how thin they are. Can you talk to us about the ballistic capability of a 30 caliber?
Yeah, so with most of these 30 calibers, and you can see the great variation in like overall size and dimensions. Basically, if you were to kind of think about it just in hunting large game at, you know, distances up to 200 yards. So this would be a relatively large, fast round.
1 second, Stephanie, and I'm so sorry because I took myself off screen to put another photo on. It actually took your sound away. So I'm going to re-ask this question and ask you to readdress it. The capability of a 30 caliber. So sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm back on screen. Okay. Now I know I can't take myself off screen.
Okay, gotcha. So the 30-06, again, being in the family of 30 caliber rounds, you'll even notice, even just from this photo, you know, if you look at just the projectile, you know, the pointy projectile sticking out of the top, they're all relatively the same size, right? They're all going to be about 0.308 inches in diameter. They're going to be roughly the same design, close to the same weights, depending on the style. But what you notice is the length of the cartridge cases. So the longer and the bigger the capacity of the cartridge case, it's designed to hold more powder, with the intention of adding, again, additional energy behind that bullet when it's fired. So the 30-06 itself within this family is one of the longer, larger cartridge cases. So designed to fire that same size bullet with more energy and for longer distances. So it's going to be faster than maybe some of its counterparts. Again, with that longer 200-yard-ish range being the ideal situation for hunting purposes.
And so, Stephanie, when we're talking about this compared to, say, a handgun round, a 9mm, 45, a 40 caliber, tell us the difference in terms of what happens to the impact on the body. And let's just address that first. Tell us about the impact of on the body for a 30 caliber at the range of 150 yards, roughly.
Right. So I think the biggest way to think about energy, as far as what energy transfers to the body or the target once it's hit, you have to think about energy in terms of, you know, mass versus velocity. So while these bullets are not only, you know, roughly the same size, maybe the same weight, maybe a little bit bigger than, say, your standard handgun round, the slender, more aerodynamic design and the amount of gunpowder behind it, as opposed to a handgun, which is, again, designed to be fired in closer distances accurately, you know, this is going to carry a lot more velocity with relatively similar mass. And velocity is exponentially related to energy, which means that increasing the velocity does exponentially increase the energy behind the bullet. So you're going to have a bullet going extremely fast and carrying a lot of energy that, once it hits the target, is going to transfer that energy over. So a 30 caliber round traveling that fast with that much energy is going to be devastating to whatever hits, more so than, say, a handgun round, which is most likely going to hit and maybe even stop, especially at those distances.
Right. So as this projectile exits the casing because of the gunpowder and that huge explosion behind it, as you mentioned, if you look at these casings, everyone, and that's the lower part that you're seeing on the bullet. The entirety of that bullet is what we call a cartridge, meaning they're both the bullet that you see at the end, the projectile, and then the casing, that is what holds the gunpowder. And so you can see what Stephanie's talking about, this huge amount of gunpowder, and then the sleekness of this bullet. And it's that huge energy behind that bullet that causes this extensive damage. So Stephanie, tell us about what a projectile will do once it enters the body. What are the possibilities for a 30 caliber to do in your body?
So, you know, a 30 caliber, again, what they're intended to do, which is why, again, they're generally hunting rounds at this point. You know, they're intended to hit large game, but penetrate deep enough in, say, a large buck or a large deer, in order to strike and damage major organs, right? In order to, if it underpenetrates, if it doesn't penetrate deep enough to cause enough damage, it won't stop the target. So when you look at the intended design for the target, that's what it's supposed to do. So when you turn that target into a person, again, with a lot less massive body structure, especially in an area like the upper body and the neck area and things like that, or maybe an arm or a limb, you know, it's instead of stopping within the target, it is going to most likely pass through. Because it's going to be, again, it's carrying enough energy that it would, you know, enter the thick, dense material of, say, a large deer or large game or something like that. So it's going to be absolutely devastating to a human.
So there's been a lot of conversation online, in mainstream media, social media, all over the place. Listen, you know, where's the bullet? Where's the bullet? Where's the bullet? Now, as of this particular recording that we're making, and this is all live, I do not know that they have yet talked about the recovery of the bullet. And we haven't heard a lot of evidence, right?
Right.
So the whole point here is that I fully anticipate them finding this bullet or projectile. Do you also, or do you have another opinion on that, Stephanie?
You know, I think the only kind of questionable area that I'm unsure of is what the area behind him consisted of. I fully do not expect that this projectile stopped in the body. This would have most definitely, I mean, obviously I can't say 100% sure, but it most definitely probably passed through and then went on to at a relatively straight trajectory, because it wouldn't really change directions or slow down considerably, just because there's not a lot of hard, thick, dense material to have slowed it down. So if it went beyond and hit something like, say, the ground or the grass, that's definitely something that with, you know, some effort, obviously, they would hopefully be able to dig out. If it went on and struck, say, a building or concrete, with the amount of energy it was carrying, it very well could have broken into, you know, multiple fragments. Again, you would still be able to recover those fragments, but it really just depends on what the surface was beyond the actual contact made with him.
And Stephanie, have you been able to look at the actual footage? I'm not going to show it on here in deference to a lot of people that, you know, don't want it shown. I definitely posted on my Twitter. We're a true crime community. For me, it is so important. I've watched it multiple times. Have you been able to watch it, Stephanie?
You know, not in the last, I'd say since it first happened, obviously, I saw it, it's, a lot of the clips lately that I have been trying to see if I could get the full video after, like the camera kind of stopped short of what's behind him. So I have yet to find a video that really gives me a better overall view of the surfaces behind him. But again, they should be able to run trajectory and figure out where the next point of contact was, which also, by the way, side note, should be able to also verify his position where he was, right? They ought to be able to follow that trajectory back to the point of origin. So I'm not really familiar with what kind of surfaces were back there and what they were maybe made out of.
Right. But you saw the bullet enter his neck, correct?
That's what it appeared. It appeared to me that you could see it enter the neck. Yeah.
And then we see the actual, I've said before, I'm not sure whether it was an artery or artery shoots you know, red blood as opposed to a vein that shoots sort of this maroon blood. Looks very different. It looks very different. What was your opinion? I'd like to get your opinion, not mine, about how that bullet entered, where it entered, and you know, what happened?
You know, it's, I think the, you know, as a forensic scientist, I'm always hesitant to speculate, right? Especially since the only thing that we have as of right now to rely on is kind of grainy video. Again, from what I could see, it looked like it hit directly and passed straight through. Again, you do see it all, almost immediately blood pulling out of the wound. But when it comes to like being able to see the detail of did it hit something first and things like that, I think that is something that we're just going to have to wait for details to come out on the autopsy, as well as maybe any sort of examinations they would do on the clothing, things like that. I'm a little hesitant to speculate just because of the poor quality of the videos that we kind of have to use right now.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. Naked eye and my lens, of course, is going to be much different than yours. You are a forensic scientist and you're going to want to see all the details regarding the entry room, regarding the exit wound, before you give an opinion as to how it entered. There's a lot of speculation about a lot of things, first of all. I mean, one is that he had on a bulletproof vest and it somehow ricocheted up. There's a lot of speculation regarding that.
Yeah, I think, you know, when it comes to some of those theories that I've seen, again, I haven't seen anything that convinces me of any of those theories. That bullet traveling that fast would not easily ricochet, much less off of body armor. Again, I also, you know, nobody has verified that there was even the presence of body armor. I've seen some videos where they talked about the movement of the shirt and, you know, the direction the strip's blowing. Again, in my opinion and in my experience, that bullet is traveling with a lot of energy and the bullet is spinning. So it is going to disturb the area around everything that it passes, right? So again, I'm not surprised by any of the parts of the video that have shown me, nothing I've seen has shown me or told me that anything other than a direct hit happened here. Again, it's all still speculation at this point, but I haven't seen anything that makes me feel like any of these kind of conspiracy theories that are floating around have any weight to them.
Right. I concur with what you say, and you are a ballistic expert, so I really defer to your opinion on this, although in this case, it mimics mine. Secondarily, in terms of this bullet, can you tell me a little bit about your background in terms of, have you ever had to deal with the ballistic capability of a 30 caliber penetrating, the ability to even penetrate body armor, whether from this distance, if it would penetrate? I'm not talking about Charlie Kirk. I'm just saying generally speaking. Right.
I'm going to be honest with you. I haven't. We just, in the crime lab, dealing with kind of everyday shooting. So first of all, 30 caliber is not something we see often, right? maybe in hunting accidents, maybe out in the, you know, in the rural areas, accidental shootings or things like that. We definitely don't see a lot of body armor. I would say, you know, probably the federal agencies have a lot more experience dealing with body armor than, say, you know, your standard firearms examiner. So, again, I'm gonna kind of punt that one. That's a little bit out of my area of direct knowledge. I haven't worked a case that involves kind of that direct scenario.
Right. Okay. Yeah, no problem. I thought you might, I didn't know if you'd ever had something, because the point that she's trying to make, Stephanie's trying to make here, is typically when you're talking about a rifle round, you're talking about a 223, 556, these other rounds that would not be accommodated by a 30-06. You have to use a 30 caliber in a 30-06. That's usually used by hunters, whereas the other cases we often see where criminals are using semi-automatic rifles, they're using this other round, a 223, 556. Is that your experience?
Yeah, that's probably more along the lines of most people in this field's experience. You know, the combination of 30 caliber rounds and body armor is probably not very common as far as criminal cases, you know, typical criminal cases go. But, you know, and it also totally depends on the body armor, right? Were there metal plates in it, or was it just Kevlar, right? Rifle rounds will pass through, you know, Kevlar relatively easy, but certain types of metal plates may stop it. There's a lot of factors that could contribute to that possibility.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because just while we're on this, when it talks to, because we kind of segued a little bit, I wanted to add that there's Kevlar bulletproof vest that takes energy and it essentially spreads it out. And that's why it can effectively on FBI agents. That's what we wore whenever we were out in the field doing any sort of operation, because particularly for handgun rounds, we were pretty much protected. But I also want to make this caveat. If you've ever seen anybody who's been shot in a vest that had on a Kevlar vest, they are completely bruised. They are still very, very wounded. It's not like what you see on TV where it hits the vest and they're like, "Woo, I'm ready to rock and roll," and they keep going. This dispersion of energy absolutely harms the body and the chest. It's unbelievable. The black and blue. And I can guarantee you this 30 caliber, this is at least my understanding in everything I know. I did not want to see a 223 or 556 or a 30 caliber because I know I would die. It would penetrate Kevlar. Period.
Yes.
And knives, for everybody who doesn't know, a knife, if somebody comes after me with a knife, that is also going to penetrate. So this is strictly, we're not talking about Charlie Kirk at this moment. We're generally speaking about bulletproof vests and you know, these types of rounds, just edification for people separately. But we put in what they call chicken plates. We call them chicken plates, which are these steel plates. And everybody had to have your chicken plate in front and back, which we always hated because they're so heavy. And but that could deter a round like this, depending on how far away it was, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And like I said, if it comes out that, you know, they verify that, yes, he did indeed have one of these, you know, titanium plates or whatever in place, you know, again, if that bullet had hit the top of it, what I would expect is that the whole bullet didn't have time to redirect directly through his neck, right? It would have probably hit and fragmented, and, you know, a large portion of the fragment would have gone, would have deflected. More likely than the whole bullet. But again, because that bullet is still moving extremely fast within 200 yards.
And we've talked about, too, the fact, for anybody joining, again, we're talking about Charlie Kirk, and we're talking with a forensic expert who's a ballistic expert. She works at the university level. She's worked in a crime lab for years, and we're just thrilled to have her expertise on here. Everybody is all upset about this bullet that nobody's discussing whether it was found or not, and she has already laid out that if it went how it appears to her that it went, me that it went, many other people, it would have been a direct hit to the neck, and that bullet would have continued to travel until it was stopped by something greater, like concrete, like ground, something like that.
Yes.
And we can't see in the video, you can't see precisely what's behind it.
Yeah, most of the videos, you know, right after that shot goes off, cameras go haywire, so you don't really... there's nothing still enough or clear enough that you can see an impact beyond beyond Mr. Kirk to see if it did indeed continue on and where it impacted. But that would have been something that they would have been able to come in afterwards, process and crime scene, and hopefully be able to find.
Okay, I'm going to stay on the projectile for a while, and I'm going to ask you some hypothetical questions. So hypothetically, if that bullet is found, in other words, if it penetrated through the neck, as we believe, and went out, because again, this is soft tissue, there wouldn't have been anything strong enough, like a metal plate or titanium or something to, you know, cause it to fragment. If it would have gone straight through, let's just say, and landed in ground, okay, or even a wooden building. Well, let's talk about ground first, if there was ground behind it. And I've explained to everybody, but you could further explain. I'd like you to caveat on this, how when you shoot a bullet, it doesn't go straight. Everybody seems so confused about this, but the bullet rises and then falls. If you ever watch a bullet, if you could just expand on that, and then I'll go back to the question.
When you're looking at the overall bullet trajectory, I mean, most people are working within a shorter range where the movement up or down in the bullet trajectory is minimal, right? But when you're dealing with rifle rounds at longer distances, that's why you have to go, if you've ever heard the phrase, sighting the gun in, you know, you have to go in and adjust the sights to be able to account for that curved trajectory. So at short distances, the trajectory is relatively flat, relatively straight, but at some point during its flight, the bullet is going to start to drop, right? It's going to slow down. It has wind resistance. It's fighting gravity. So at some point, it's going to start to drop. And it's not, obviously, it's not going to stop until it hits something solid enough to slow it down enough to actually stop.
All right. Perfect. Now, when we're talking about, we're going to in our hypothetical here, if this bullet then, let's just say it stops at ground because it goes up and what's behind it ends up being ground that it hits. What are the chances that a projectile would be able to be retrieved and to be compared successfully against the rifle, the Mauser 30-06 that they have?
I would say the chances, from my experience, the chances are pretty high. You know, the ground is going to stop it kind of fast. So again, it's probably going to be damaged, but they should be able to find the projectile mostly intact, but just maybe damaged. And again, hopefully that damage isn't enough to completely obliterate the tool marks that they're going to need to match it to back to the gun. But I'd say the chances are pretty high if it's in the ground that they'll be able to find it, recover it, and potentially affect a match or at least a comparison.
And talk to us about the extractor, the ejector, the firing pin. These are tool marks, but please go into detail about how that would be compared, and they do have the casing. The casing was recovered in the blanket. There were three cartridges, meaning full bullets, and one cartridge that was from the spent bullet, the one that shot and killed Charlie. Tell us about this. Tell us about how that's compared, and will they be able to make a definite match or not, usually under these circumstances?
Yeah, so in general, when we're comparing, ammunition after it's been fired, you have two separate items that you would have to do a comparison. You've got the cartridge casing, right, which stays kind of with the gun or near the gun. In this case, this is a bolt-action rifle, which means that after it's fired, the casing itself, the large metallic casing, would actually stay inside the gun, unless somebody manually moved the bolt to the rear in order to, again, extract it, which is to pull it out of the chamber and then eject it from the firearm. Somebody would manually have to do that. It doesn't happen automatically like, say, in a semi-automatic firearm, where that's part of the natural process or firing process. So the cartridge case itself would come into contact with very specific parts of the gun, and it would transfer tool marks onto those surfaces. So when we do a comparison, what we would do is take test fires of that same suspect firearm, that firearm created those tool marks, and then we would compare those tool marks to, say, an unknown. In this case, most likely the cartridge case was either with the gun or maybe even still in the chamber of the firearm itself. So we would look at things like the firing pin that strikes, the primer, the little sensitive explosive area on the back of the case. That would leave an impression. Again, different types of tool marks would be transferred over during that firing process.
So because this is a bolt action as opposed to semi-automatic that actually has extractors and ejectors that then take that casing and toss it out, and then a new bullet enters, because with a bolt action, you pull back on it and you manually eject it. What exactly in where the casing would be, what would make the marks on it from the bolt action Mauser?
So, there's a few gun parts that would be in direct contact and potentially leave identifiable tool marks on the cartridge case, again, the casing, the big, large brass metal container. And that would be, first, the extractor and ejector will interact with kind of the rim area. Again, the extractor is kind of like a little hook that sits right under the edge of the rim. And it simply is responsible for pulling the edge of that rim rearward to pull the cartridge case out of the chamber, right, after it's been fired. The ejector is a part that is going to contact the cartridge case once it gets far enough back out of the chamber as the bolt is pulling it back with the extractor. And it's going to strike that ejector, which kind of is a fixed post. So you're backing up and you run into a mailbox, right? And that post is going to smack the back of the cartridge case and push it out of the opening. So those two particular parts will potentially leave tool marks that you would be able to, again, compare back to tests from the gun. The two main parts that are affiliated with the firing process are the firing pin, which is what is released when you pull the trigger. The firing pin ultimately is responsible for contacting the ammunition and detonating it. That's going to leave an impression, again, on the back of the cartridge case. And then there's an actual surface that the firing pin passes through called the breech face. That's the face of the bolt that the cartridge case sits against, that again has a hole in it that the firing pin is allowed to pass through. That also bears tool marks that can be impressed upon the cartridge case under the high pressure of the firing process. So those are four of the main tool marks that we could use, any combination of them, in order to do a comparison of a cartridge case to, say, test fires from a gun.
Great.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it totally makes sense. And I wanted the audience to understand this process and why, particularly when you have four tool marks and they're not manual tool marks, but they're done with the energy of actually a bullet being fired, they can prove to be extremely reliable, especially when you have four to compare. All the ones we just talked about, breech face, firing pin, extractor, ejector, in concert.
You have a lot of options.
Right. Okay. So I've just been notified by Atticus, who's she's amazing. She works on our team. And she said that she believes and actually has sent photos recently that it was concrete
oh, wow.
behind.
Okay.
So talk to us now about if indeed this is true, and everybody, I'll post this on Twitter. If it was concrete that projectile would have hit after it went through the neck area, artery, vein, everything, spinal column, potentially, what would you expect?
I would expect that bullet struck concrete, again, still traveling at a high rate of speed, it's going to be pretty damaged. It's probably going to break into multiple fragments. Concrete is going to stop it a little fast, a little hard, but that does not necessarily mean that you wouldn't be able to recover enough fragments or large enough fragments to still be able to do a comparison of the tool marks. It's going to be more challenging if the bullet's not intact, if it's fragmented and broken into pieces, but it's still possible. It's definitely something that we do on a daily basis.
Okay, and in terms of, let's talk a little bit about entrance wounds and exit wounds with a 30 caliber like this. What can we expect the entrance wound to look like in comparison to the exit wound?
I'm not necessarily a medical examiner. I've seen a lot of bullet wounds, right, and consulting in the medical examiner's office, but you know, honestly, what I would expect is this to be, since there's just not a lot of material, thickness of material to slow anything down, I imagine it's going to be a relatively clean through and through. But again, the wound, the energy that bullet is carrying is really going to do a lot of tissue damage. So I would expect the inside of the wound, and particularly at the exit, because again, it's going to carry all of that energy with it as it travels through. The exit is probably going to be pretty devastating because, again, that energy, that tissue damage is going to kind of travel in that direction along with the energy.
Agreed. And just talking for anybody who's just joining, we're talking with Stephanie, who is a tool marks ballistic expert, been in the field for years. In fact, tell us how many years, Stephanie.
My background is mostly in state crime labs. So I worked for a little over 17 years, both in the North Carolina State Crime Lab system as well as the Virginia State Crime Lab system, as a fireman tool mark examiner. So the main main job duties are the examination of fired ammunition components to determine if they come from either the same firearm or a specific firearm. You can still compare fired ammunition components to each other even if you don't have a firearm. It's all based on the same types of tool marks I've already described. So majority of what we spend our time doing is microscope work. And that's predominantly what I did. So other things that we also do in addition to the microscopy work is, again, consulting with medical examiners where there's issues of distance and stippling and things like that. When I was in North Carolina, I did some trajectory analysis on crime scenes, again, for about 7 years that I was there. And then ultimately, about 6 years ago, I kind of left the crime lab world and came over to teach firearm and tool mark analysis for the VCU program.
Well, again, we are thrilled to have you and your expertise here. So I have a quick question. So now that we understand that the projectile, possibly, I have not seen the pictures, but if indeed concrete was behind it and you said it would obviously fragment, how is that put together? Is it like a puzzle? You gather all the different pieces of the projectile and make it one?
You don't necessarily have to make it one. Honestly, you know, when we're giving advice or training crime scene investigators, we tell them that, you know, we can find tool marks on even the smallest of bullet fragments. So what we're really looking for, our goal is not to piece them together necessarily. Our goal is to get enough fragments, or at least a large enough fragment that still bears good quality tool marks to, again, be able to compare back to test fires from that gun. So, you know, we can have 25 fragments, and it only takes one to have decent tool marks on it to be able to match that. Beyond that, we see how many different fragments we might be able to match, again, back to the test fires. And then we might be able, on a secondary level, to kind of piece that bullet back together like a puzzle and put it back together according to the tool marks and how they're distributed.
All right. I'd like to switch now from the projectile. You really explained all those scenarios to us so well, and how tool marks work to identify a gun that shot a particular projectile. I want to talk about the casing. And for everyone who doesn't know, in the blanket where the gun was left in that wooded area right there off of campus, there was the three cartridges, which means the full bullet, like what you see in this picture here, that were found. And again, he edged words on the casing about fascists and about, if you're reading this, you're gay. And, you know, we went over this on the previous show. But there was also, he picked up the casing. So the casing that we've been talking about that holds that projectile and the gunpowder, he didn't leave it up on the roof. He decided to take it with him. Talk to us about, with a known casing that's believed to be a gun, how probable is it that they'll be able to say that casing came from that Mauser 30-06?
I mean, generally speaking, again, you know, we describe all of the tool marks we described earlier, the firing pin, the breech face, the extractor, the ejector, all of those are tool marks that would be on the casing itself. So generally speaking, we have a lot more success in making identifications or matches with cartridge cases than, say, a bunch of damaged bullet fragments. Bullets are usually a little bit more challenging microscopically, even though they only contact one part of the gun, which is the barrel. So it's kind of a trade-off. If we have so many tool marks to choose from, it increases our odds that one of those tool marks will be of sufficient quality to be able to match it back to that part of that gun.
Great. That this is just so, I think, helpful for everybody to understand that casing is most likely, very likely, going to be able to be matched to that weapon or not to that weapon. In other words, they're going to be able to look at it and say, that fired out of this or didn't fire. Now, let me ask you this. With the other projectiles, what have you heard about, I should say cartridges, with the other cartridges, what have you heard, if anything, about those rounds?
I actually haven't heard much. Of course, I will also admit that I've been a little bit out of the loop the last couple of days, and this is a quickly evolving case. I've been kind of out of the count with a pinched nerve in my neck. So I haven't been keeping up with it as much the last couple of days. So I haven't heard much about it, other than what everybody else has heard as far as the etchings and things like that.
Right. I was curious. I've read various things, and in the big presser, which was to me, what I rely on is what comes from law enforcement, what comes from the medical examiner's office. I do rely on outlets. For instance, I trust News Nation. I work for News Nation, and I know what they go through to, you know, before they decide to, you know, emit something into the ether for all of us to read and see. But I'm very careful at looking at what I'm going before I say something. I have not seen from law enforcement, the prosecutor didn't talk particularly about these rounds. So I'm just kind of interested because, as you said, all of these that you see on the screen, these are all 30-06 rounds and you can, or 30 caliber rounds, and you can see how similar they are. And I'm not sure how much of an impact it'll have one way or the other, but can you talk to us about really any impact it would have if it's one versus another?
So the extra unfired rounds?
Yes. I'm just talking generally about, say, gotcha. It's item one in this line going left to right versus right. item nine.
So, yeah, I think the first thing that, like, I would want to know as a firearms examiner is, you know, where were they recovered? Were they in the gun still? Were they in the magazine? Because this gun has an internal magazine. So were they already removed from the gun, or were they removed from the gun by law enforcement? You know, that would be one important question to be answered. If we assume that they were not in the gun, you know, were they also the same type or brand as the fired cartridge case? So the one thing that we would look at from a forensic aspect is, were the brands consistent, right? Was it four Winchester cartridge cases with a similar style bullet than the one recovered, you know, on the other end of the shooting, assuming that they recover enough of it to be able to tell. I think that, honestly, the biggest advantage to having unfired rounds with the evidence is if for some reason this ammunition is unique and marks in a very specific way, the best case scenario for a firearms examiner is to shoot the same type of ammunition as was used in the case. So in the instance where maybe it's some sort of unique ammunition that is hard to find, at least they would have some evidence rounds to be able to test fire if they needed to. So that's sometimes where the unfired ammunition can come in handy in a case like this. Or even just to, again, it doesn't really mean anything if they were all different brands, but having the same brand that was used in the original shooting can be an advantage, because sometimes the hardness or the material of the case can affect the transfer of tool marks.
You know, something you said that's very important that I have not talked about a lot, and I'm glad you brought it up, is there is a magazine capability. In other words, the ability to inject more than one of these cartridges. And even though it doesn't cycle, meaning after you shoot, it doesn't spit it out, you have to manually use a bolt action to have it eject. The question that has not been answered is, were those three rounds maintained in the weapon, or were they just in the blanket? I'm going to guess right. In the weapon, but
I had to guess. That's usually the scenario. Usually the scenario is somebody shoots in a situation like this and they don't necessarily have the forethought to just unload everything, right? Maybe they did, maybe they didn't in this situation, but I'd be interested to know, because if the round that was fired was ejected, say, on the rooftop, and the suspect picked it up to take it with him, then if you assume that he manually pulled the bolt back in order to eject it, then as soon as he closed the bolt, he would have then loaded a new round into the chamber and recocked the firing mechanism, which means that when they find the gun or recover the gun in that state, they would have a fired cartridge case separate from the gun, one in the chamber, and potentially two in the magazine. So again, I haven't heard whether they were in the gun, out of the gun, or any of those scenarios.
But he would have to take the bolt forward for that scenario. If he kept it back, then it would be empty. So this leads me to my next question. Many people following the case know there was a screwdriver that was found right next to the weapon and was left on the roof. And when you see him descend the roof, you don't see this sort of long Mauser 30-06 rifle with him. And it's believed he disassembled. talk to us about, and I know you can't disassemble that whole Mauser rifle, but I thought you could take off the stock from the receiver. Is that right?
You can, and that's, again, I think that's one important aspect of looking at the actual picture. Like in the standard old authentic Mauser, it was actually a very involved process to get that old wood stock off of the barrel and the action. But in this sort of like polymer frame, it's actually relatively easy. A couple screws being removed should allow you to break it into the stock versus the barrel and kind of the receiver area. I think, you know, I've heard that kind of theory as well. You know, I've studied the video really closely, and it, again, it's just poor quality of video. But when they take the picture, or at least the picture that they show, the gun is fully assembled. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be interesting to see how that kind of information trickles out of, did he disassemble it, carry out there, and then reassemble it when he left it? Did he ever disassemble it? I would assume that's what the screwdriver was for, that maybe he had the intention of doing that. I'm definitely interested to see how that information pans out. It, in my opinion, just from looking at the video, it's a little hard to tell. You do see something. You see the towel kind of flopping around in the wind because they end up finding it wrapped in a towel. I'm not sure. It would still be two very long pieces. The barrel will still be relatively long, even if it was removed from the receiver. But I'm interested myself in seeing how that information kind of trickles out.
And were you able to see the footage from TMZ where he's walking in this sort of limping fashion? And a lot of people believe he has the gun, the rifle in his jeans. And I want to preface this by saying, and everybody who watched yesterday knows that when I was in Montana at a shooting school over the weekend, I put a rifle in my pant leg. Now, I will say it didn't have a scope, but I also will say I'm 5 foot nothing, about 5 foot one and a half. I'm short. And I have bird legs. Actually, people have called me bird legs as a nickname. I'm not proud of it, but it's a fact. And when I put that rifle in there, I was able to walk and run without limping. You know?
Oh, wow.
I mean, I really could bend my knee sort of. And now I'm not saying the gun bent, obviously it stayed straight, but I was really surprised at how easily I was still able to walk. Again, I didn't have a scope on this rifle.
Right.
Iron sighted. Right. But do you believe from what you saw, and I know this is getting out of your tool marks and, you know, ballistic expertise, but just as somebody who's very familiar with firearms, what did you make of that? Do you think he had the rifle down his pants?
I mean, I can't remember. Was that video footage that was taken before the shooting occurred? Was this the lead up to the shooting?
Yeah, well, twofold.
Or was it after?
A lot of people didn't watch the TMZ video. I posted it on my Twitter, by the way, if anybody wants to see it. But essentially, it shows him in the neighborhood and it shows him walking.
Right.
But if you go to the very end, like, I don't know, it's 1 minute long or something like that. But at the very end, it shows him running behind the neighborhood and then coming around. It doesn't look like he's particularly limping. And I'm not saying he had a limp. I'm just saying I don't know exactly the configuration. I wondered, so let me tell you what I thought when I saw that. Just judging from it, I wondered if it wasn't disassembled at that time. And because I thought I could see the stock, so not the full rifle, and that if he had the other half in that backpack, and then when he went, I wondered if he assembled it. That's what the screwdriver was for, not after the shooting, but before. That was kind of my thought.
That's exactly what I thought too, actually. Yeah, my thought was, I don't know that I'm convinced that it was disassembled after the fact, but just looking from, like, it would have been really hard to conceal that gun fully assembled. And, like, you see the backpack photos of the stairwell and stuff like that. But I could see that, I could see the stock fitting in the bag and the barrel, which is going to be a little bit shorter without the stock added to it, being able to put down the pants leg and not really prevent you from being able to bend your leg and stuff. So that was actually my kind of thought as well.
And it could be, I suppose he could have had the whole thing stuffed down his leg. I mean, it's possible. And maybe that's why he was limping. But I really thought he was limping because it was slipping.
Yeah.
So if he had it like in the waistband and he's like, oh my gosh, I got to make sure this thing doesn't come out the bottom of my leg.
Right. That's right.
How I took it. That's how I took it. Okay. Let's see. I want to make sure there is nothing else I forgot to ask you. I think we've really covered it so well. Is there anything you can think of that I might have missed?
I don't think so. I mean, I even made it, I jotted a few notes down just of things that I've kind of thought of as I've followed this case. And I think we've covered everything that I kind of pinpointed as talking points.
And for anybody who joined late, I've really challenged you. Hopefully you might go and watch from the beginning. I'm seeing a lot of questions in chat that we covered at the beginning, but probably people are rolling in late and so forth. I want to say this, and you know, we try to have really high quality guests on this program, no nonsense, that know what the heck they're talking about. There's no better guest that we could ever have to talk about ballistics, tool marks, than Stephanie.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
I mean, just her, whenever you're in a state crime lab, everybody, you see so much more than you're going to see in a lot of other arenas. This stuff is pouring in because it's a state crime lab. You're handling everything that's happening in that state, North Carolina and Virginia in this case, and then now teaching it. She's actually teaching other examiners, listen, this is what you need to look for. No, this little mark is not a tool mark. This is something else. So I think I just wanted to say, Stephanie, thank you for being a friend of the show and for coming on and lending us your expertise.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you inviting me back. I'd love to spread knowledge. So,
well, I will be calling you again. We have a lot of cases where this type of information is critical. And thank you. Thank you for taking so much time, Stephanie. I'll see you soon. I'll call you after.
Thanks a lot. Don't be a stranger.
All right. I will. Thank you. Oh, you guys, she is so good. We are truly, truly a friend of the show. I want to say, too, this show today is really about giving some knowledge and information, particularly related to the bullet, particularly related to the gun, as it pertains to the shooting and to all these crazy, mythical, conspiracy, wackadoodle ideas out there. So hopefully we've provided some knowledge and some actual tangible information for everybody to consider. I also want to say, you know, my heart continues to go out to Charlie Kirk's children and to his wife. Again, for me, people who follow this channel, you know, this is not about politics. This is about freedom of speech. This is about being able to go in public and say something and not be fearful of somebody hunting you down and attacking you and assassinating you for your beliefs. I love what Charlie Kirk said when he said, when we can no longer have discourse with one another, conversation, discuss our differences, discuss our ideas, that's when things turn violent. And that's really what happened. Even though he was trying to have conversation, that's when everything ended up turning violent. So everyone, my mods, thank you for being here. Everybody in chat, we had such a big audience, such a great audience. Thank you so much for being here. Some of those who have know a lot of guns. I so appreciate your input. And for those who know nothing about guns, I hope today you were able to learn some things. She did a great job of explaining. I want to send a special shout out to Tom Fleming. Tom, you're always have been such a huge supporter of the channel. Thank you for donating those 5 memberships. I think he's donated memberships. In fact, I know before. And Tom, thank you so much. And I hope people here in the chat will take advantage of becoming a member. We do private. I do a lot of lives that I make private right away. So only members can see them and then later release them. So really hope to just send my thanks to you all for being here. God bless Charlie Kirk and his family and all of you for listening in. Until next time, may justice be served.
Want to break the case with Jennifer Coffendaffer even more? Then press subscribe right now and join Jen on YouTube. Just search Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer now.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
2 ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.